Talk to me about writing the book, The New New Deal, and not really getting an interview from President Obama. Was that awkward?
You know, it would have been. I mean, I wish Obama had talked to me. He, I think, felt kind of burned by some of the earlier books on his White House. But I got plenty of time with Vice President Biden. I think by definition, when you have an interview with Biden, it's a long interview. And he let me sit in on cabinet meetings that he was leading, just dealing with the stimulus. And other than the president, I had access to just about every person in his administration who dealt with the stimulus, as well as most of the leading Republicans who were on the other side of the stimulus debate. So I didn't feel, I of course wished that he had spoken to me, but I felt like I had really good access to tell the behind the scenes story. And he's certainly an active player in this book. Like, you hear words coming out of his voice, words coming out of his mouth. You know, the stories that he's involved in, I was definitely able to get people to fill in the blanks.
What was your impression of seeing the way the White House and the administration work? Is there a clear communication going on, or are people confused about what's happening, or what's your general impression?
You know, it's not sexy and it's not going to sell me a lot of books. But the sort of takeaway from my book about Obama is that, you know, he's sort of done what he said he was going to try to do. And that he is kind of what he said he was. He's this left of center, pragmatic technocrat who doesn't let the perfect become the enemy of the good. And although he did campaign as this change the system outsider, he really has governed as this work the system insider. He recognizes that bills that don't get 60 votes in the Senate and don't pass Congress don't make change. So I think there was. I do tell the story in the book, some of the way they really did try to focus on getting the policy right. And they were under this sort of dumb impression that if they just focus on policy, the politics will take care of itself. That was not always the case. And the best example you mentioned is with those tax cuts, where they, the economist said that instead of sending everybody a check, they should just dribble out the money a few dollars a week, because that way people are less likely to notice it and more likely to spend it. But then they're less likely to notice it. And as Rahm Emanuel ran around saying, he's like, we're denying ourselves an Ed McMahon moment. You know, that sort of squeal of Publishers Clearinghouse pleasure where you get your check in the mail from Barack. That didn't happen. It was kind of like, you know, sending your romantic interest flowers without signing the note. And I think that has taken a real political toll. Yes, you see 95% of the country got a tax cut and less than 10% of the country notices it. That's a political failure.
One of the just kind of passing moments in the book, but I thought was really interesting to put a point on history, was that as they were trying to get the votes ready to pass the stimulus, you talk about Harry Reid having to pull the Kennedy card. And poor Ted Kennedy, who was ailing at this point, they said, you know, are you going to make Ted Kennedy come back for to break a filibuster or something like that? Get inside those politics and, you know, how close was it there?
Sure. Well, I really focused on the drive to get 60 votes in the Senate, because it really did. It shaped the stimulus, and it's really shaped the entire Obama presidency, going on with health care reform and Wall Street reform. It really has been driven by this, you know, how do you round up the votes when just about the entire Republican Party is committed to oppose everything that Obama wants? At one point, Harry Reid did bring in three kind of veteran Republican senators and first made this pitch, hey, you know, we helped President Bush out with the bank bailout. You've got to help us out with Main Street. And they sort of said, no. And so then he really did play the Kennedy card. He said, look, well, you know, Ted Kennedy's sick. And if you don't support this, we're going to have to wheel him out onto the Senate floor to vote for this, and it'll probably kill him. And they looked at each other and sort of said, huh, what's he talking about? But then they did make an appeal. Well, OK, well, even if you don't support this, can you at least pair your vote with Senator Kennedy? So everybody will understand that you're against it and he's for it. But since so he won't have to come to the floor, you just vote for it on his behalf. And they wouldn't even do that. Even some of Senator Kennedy's best friends in the Senate. And it did show the kind of the way this had become so partisan. The actual final vote, they had to hold it open for 5 hours. It was the longest vote ever in the U.S. Senate because Sherrod Brown of Ohio, his mother had just died. And they would not, nobody would pair his vote. So they had to send, you know, he had to fly out to the funeral in Ohio, then come back to cast his vote, then come back to Ohio for the memorial service. When people talk about how the sort of breakdown of civility and the hyper ultra partisanship in Washington, it's the stimulus is a pretty stark example.
One of the really interesting things in the early part of the book was you talk about kind of the excitement around energy policy and creating new energy technologies. And you highlight that by pointing out that essentially a new branch of government was created. There's, of course, DARPA, the Defense Agency Research Advanced Research Projects, or I'm not saying it right. What is it? Defense Advanced Research Projects. Anyway,
Agency, yeah.
There's DARPA, but there was also, they created, and that's for the Defense Department, but there was a whole new division of along those lines created just for energy. Explain how did that start?
ARPA-E, which was,
ARPA-E.
Again, was another idea that had been floated down back during the Bush administration that never got any support, and the stimulus made it happen. It created this, you know, this sort of crazy out-of-the-box research agency, the kind of place where Q from the James Bond movies would want to work, where their motto is no incremental improvements. We're only interested in game changers. And they're trying to invent better batteries for electric vehicles and, better transformers for the grid and better biofuels. They invented entirely new categories of biofuels. They're trying to improve on photosynthesis, which is, you know, only been working for 3.5 billion years. But it really is, you know, these brainiacs who are exempt from civil service rules. So they really were the kind of dreamers that you don't picture coming to government to change the world. But they're already coming up with very exciting advances in solar manufacturing, a company called 1366 Technologies, which is going to really cut the cost of silicon wafers in half. They're coming up with wind turbines that are shaped like jet engines. There are these new things called electrofuels, which are sort of using these algae that to create fuels. They're algae that you'd find in like hot springs,
or like deep sea vents, or something.
Yeah, it's just really completely out of the box, crazy stuff. You know, batteries that don't even use lithium, right? They're lithium, or it's just. They're really smart scientists doing really exciting things. And the idea is that, you know, these are going to be the clean energy technologies of tomorrow that that will lead us away from carbon emissions and will fuel our economy in 20 years.
If the administration changes, though, from Obama 2.0 to Romney 1.0, would something like that still exist?
Actually, ARPA-E is one of the only stimulus projects that Romney has said he supports. And I do think, look, in 2010, when the Republicans had their pledge to America, one of their number one promises, one of their big pledges, was that they were going to rescind all the unspent stimulus money, which at the time was $200 billion. And of that couple hundred billion, they rescinded zero. People kind of like their projects. It's hard to take things away. And the history of the Republican Party has been that they've talked a lot about tax cuts and a lot about spending cuts, and they've kept their promises about tax cuts, and they have not kept their promises about spending cuts. So I think a lot of these projects, they might have more staying power even under a Romney administration than people think.
Maybe you could make that point that even though someone like Governor Rick Scott rejected money on high-speed rail, that meant it didn't go back to the government and just go away. It did get passed on in effect.
That's right. That's right. When Florida sent back the money, it went to California and the Northeast to work on Acela, and the Midwest to reduce trip times from Chicago to St. Louis and Chicago to Detroit. So it was just, I suppose it was a kind of principled stand, but it was really helped the rest of the country at Florida's expense.
It sounds like physics to me. No energy is destroyed, or no matter is really destroyed, right?
Right.
The money is not really,
exactly.
Not really gone.
Exactly.
Anyway, Mike Grunwald, it's been great to speak to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Mark.